From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Billions of public dollars will be invested in public infrastructure in Baltimore in the next few years. We talk about it with reporter Edward Erickson, who wrote about the building boom for the City Paper, and we get an update on the progress of one project in particular, Baltimore school renovations. Then Tom Hall talks with poet Eilish Hopper about her new book of poems, Dark Sky Society, which explores America's racial lines.
There's a necessary level of discomfort, I think, to get inside what I'm talking about. And if I just kind of give the answer to somebody, they won't actually get the answer. So sometimes refusing to get it and just say, you need to maybe ask that question of yourself.
Plus, Tom talks with opera star Jessie Norman about her new memoir, First News.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WIPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
Good morning. This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore is planning some big infrastructure projects, billions of dollars worth. The plans include rebuilding the sewer and water systems, creating an expanded business district, constructing the Red Line, and upgrading or completely rebuilding between 23 and 28 Baltimore public schools. These developments to the city's infrastructure will take years to finish and create thousands of jobs. But many of Baltimore's big plans are off to slow starts. And joining me to talk about it is Edward Erickson. He's a reporter for the City Paper. He wrote a cover story last week called Baltimore's New Deal. Edward, good morning.
Good morning, Sheila.
I appreciate your joining us. You wrote in your story that when it comes to big infrastructure plans, there is, quote, no plan at all. Tell me what you meant by that.
Well, what I meant by that is what I expected as a citizen is somebody within the city or in a regional sort of planning agency or, you know, at the mayor's office to talk about how all the different projects kind of fit together. And, you know, for the future of the city and as a jobs program for, you know, thousands and thousands of people in the city who, you know, don't have jobs, maybe want jobs. And what I found, somewhat to my surprise, was that because each of these projects is managed by sort of a different agency or bureaucracy with a different funding stream, there wasn't any really overall plan. It just seemed to all be happening at once, and nobody had seized it as an opportunity to, again, make jobs and make some excitement for the amount of public infrastructure rebuilding that's going on right now.
Well, how much overall do you, as you tally things up, do you think could be spent in the next several years?
That was the amazing thing to me. If you added everything up and you were very generous, so, for example, the schools are now spending just under $1 billion, but the original plan was for $2.4 billion to really renovate about 100 buildings. Okay, so if you added everything out, it was around $11 to $12 billion, okay, over about 7-8 years, which is a huge amount of money in the local economy.
You say it's close to being comparable to what was spent in Baltimore in the New Deal for the WPA projects.
Yeah. Yeah, at the low end, at $7 billion, and that's assuming that the Red Line sort of doesn't happen, you're at about half a New Deal. And again, I kind of tried to figure this out based on the regional gross product, which is actually a number, and it's in the neighborhood of $150, $160 billion a year. And if you look at the figures that are being, if you look at it at the low end, it'd be about half of what the New Deal spent nationally in terms of GDP or gross national or gross domestic product. So, yeah, it's a big number. And, of course, if it were the huge amount, the $11, $12 billion, you'd be closer to three-quarters of a New Deal.
And so you reached out to people in economic development circles in Baltimore. They either didn't respond to your queries, or they didn't confirm your thesis that that there's a building boom coming to Baltimore comparable to the New Deal. Why do you think you're not getting public voices to sign on to this theory of yours?
Well, there actually, my thesis was confirmed by no less than three prominent local economists in terms of the numbers and the potential impact on the local economy. What wasn't confirmed was my idea that somebody or maybe a group of people ought to be thinking of these projects in those terms, in the terms of it could be a new deal. And why didn't people get back to me? I am not entirely sure. I expected when I talked to the mayor's office that somebody would take me by the hand and say, oh, yes, you know, we're glad you noticed. You know, here's what we're doing, and here's why it's a big deal. And you know what? We've been talking about it and very loudly, and you've just been missing it. But instead, that's not what happened, and that's what kind of surprised me. So there it is.
What did your reporting tell you about Baltimore's ability to fill the jobs that will be required to turn these projects into reality?
Well, I did a little reporting on this, and it's not definitive. But what I found was that we have programs in place for construction trades, for people to be trained in from zero, not even having a GED. But they're pretty small bore. So one program I spoke to, which is a pretty good one, they had trained about 350 people over this past, I can't remember how many years, it might have been 10. That is great, and it's a big job, and it costs money, but they don't have a lot of funding because, you know, they pay people to come to these classes, you know, as if they were real people who really needed to, you know, make a living, you know. So it doesn't look like we have what I would think we would need in order to make, say, 6,000 or 5,000 people job ready, which is what I think we might need, okay? But that's just me talking, and there's more reporting to be done on that. I think it's something that's – and plus there's also more time to do it because a lot of these projects are either not off the ground yet or are sort of just slowly getting off the ground, like the school construction project, which is only half funded and is and they've been cutting it back.
And we're going to talk about that right now. Edward, I appreciate your talking to us. I appreciate your reporting, and I'm sure you're going to do more of it. We will keep an eye on your reporting. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for noticing the story and helping to have the conversation continue, because it's an interesting one.
Edward Erickson, he's a reporter for Baltimore City Paper. We've got a link to his story at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. On WYPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. One of the biggest infrastructure projects, as Edward just mentioned, the renovation or complete rebuilding of between 23 and 28 schools. Those numbers are down from the initial estimate of 30 to 35 schools that was given last year at the time the legislation for state funding went through the General Assembly. Here's Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake in lobbying for the school's funding, describing conditions of Baltimore schools in 2012, courtesy of WBAL.
I continue to be embarrassed by the physical condition of some of our schools. Too many without air conditioning, too few labs, computer labs, regular labs, too many with water fountains that our children can't even drink from.
And joining us here with me in the studio to discuss the school renovations is Keith Scroggins, Chief Operating Officer of Baltimore City Public Schools. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us is David Lever, Executive Director of Maryland's Public School Construction Program. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Dr. Scroggins, give us an update. How soon will ground be broken on the new schools? How soon will work start on the renovations?
Presently, the plan is that we will break ground in December of 2015 and early 2016.
That's for the new build, the
for the new both, and or both. Renovated buildings. Yeah.
So we're not going to see any construction this year.
No, ma'am.
And relate for us, if you would, because there's been some headlines recently of the schools have announced a plan to close six other schools. Is that a separate track, or do these things relate to each other?
Actually, they do relate, and the total number will be 26 buildings that we intend to close. We, as part of our program and the 21st century plan, we are looking to close buildings and open buildings by renovation or complete building. But we plan to give the neighborhoods, if we close a school in a neighborhood, we will be building a school in that neighborhood. So we're going to give them something better than what they had before. And what we're really looking to do is to improve the learning environment for our students.
So the schools that you've announced closing so far, Langston Hughes Elementary, Abbotson Elementary, Dr. Rainer Brown Academy, Northeast Middle, WEB, Du Bois High, and Heritage High. And you're saying that's sort of the first group, but there will be others closed as new schools are built.
Well, there are some differences there because what you're mentioning are programs. We are closing some school programs. That's different from closing the buildings. So, as in the case of Northeast Middle, the intention is to move another school program into that building, and that program will be the existing program, while the Northeast Middle program, it basically goes away, but the students will still be there and the building will be open.
And I don't know who to throw this to. Perhaps, Dr. Levy, you could answer this. As I mentioned, when the General Assembly passed the legislation for funding, we were talking about 30 or 35 schools, mm-hmm. and now we're talking about fewer. Why?
The 30 to 35 was based on conceptual understandings of the scope of the schools. That came out of the study that was done in 2011-2012 by a consultant to Baltimore City Public Schools that defined the type of school. This would be renovation, this would be replacement. In some cases, it would be replacement or renovation. In other words, saying those are decisions that would have to be taken later on based on actually looking at this project and developing a feasibility study. The 30 to 35 was based on the best information that was available at the time of the size of the schools and what the scope would be. A year later, as we got into this whole process with the Maryland Stadium Authority, hard decisions were made.
Maryland Stadium Authority, which was given by the legislature the job of estimating costs in this process.
Yes, and they will be issuing the bonds. They'll be managing the replacement projects, working very, very closely, and that's already developed, working very closely with city schools on the renovation project. So it's a very unified effort. But they took a very hard look this past summer at the costs that were involved and the actual square footages and scope of these projects, and based on that began to develop a much more realistic sense of what the actual cost would be on an individual project-by-project basis. And that led to a revision of the total number that could be done within the just under $1 billion that will be available.
I am so sorry. I got caught up in talking to you, but we're flat out of time, so we're going to have to continue this conversation, and I appreciate you both coming in on a rainy day like this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's David Levy. Excuse me. He's right. Executive Director of Maryland's Public School Construction Program, and Dr. Scroggins, Keith Scroggins, Chief Operating Officer of Baltimore City Public Schools. More information on our website and more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. My guest this morning is Ailish Hopper. She's an assistant professor of peace studies at Goucher College in Towson and the author of a new collection of poetry called Dark Sky Society. Her poems are largely about race and that consistently uncomfortable color line between whites and blacks. She writes in verse that one critic describes as coiled and sprung, and she deals with the legacies and complexities of the racial divide in America. Ailish Hopper joins me in the studio. It's good to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
So why does the issue of race hold such a prominent position in your work?
Oh, you know, I have so many answers to that question. I think number one is just that I grew up in D.C., which when I was growing up was, you know, known as Chocolate City. So I think I was really immersed in that experience. Probably also things in just my particular biography. My mom is not American and is from a country that's partitioned from Ireland. And she was a single mom, so in my house was kind of Ireland, and then I would step out into D.C. And I think that kind of attuned my ear and my eye to the division in a particular way. And, you know, I don't know. I don't really know anyone who grew up in D.C., my generation, too, who isn't pretty attuned to that, especially growing up in D.C. I mean, I was coming of age, meaning I was a teenager, when, you know, Rodney King was beaten, and we had the trial and the rebellion after that. We had the O.J. trial. D.C. had our mayor imprisoned and then reelected. I mean, there's just a lot of complicated national race things happening for, and I remember being a kid and looking at all this and saying, you know, how does this all add up?
You even wrote a poem about the complexities of writing about this. Mm-hmm. As a white poet, let me ask you to read that one. It's called To Ignorance. It's on page 89 in your collection. And it's interesting, you take up this very issue about, you know, how complicated it is.
To Ignorance. Entering Penn Station, I see a man, hands tracing the slats of a wooden bench. But I keep moving, think he's all right, as departures Vermo, Harris, Revolve, Cascade. At track number 5 stops in. Then I notice his body's still waving. Invisible, the current, thimbleful of junk, steady swimming in his bloodstream. Today, someone asks why I am writing about race. I look up at the ceiling's false sky, told shapes fatal as hope. I have, I say, a gentle answer and a tough. Which do you want? My head's already hurting with memory, like the time I called by his first name, my professor who was black. Or when someone asked about my poems, if I would do the dialect. He chooses tough. And I say, actually, that one, you have to learn for yourself. The station glitters with windows dark. How do I look? I say to my reflected self. Keep moving, says a voice that disappears so quickly, it is as if it was never there at all.
Eilish Hopper reading from her latest collection of poetry, Dark Sky Society. It's a poem called To Ignorance. So you ask this question of yourself in the poem, why are you writing about race? You say there's a gentle and a tough answer. And then you duck the answer in the poem. I mean, is there a gentle and a tough answer? Are there two sides to that?
Yeah, I mean, that actually is. That's a way I used to deal in Q&As with people who would ask me that question, because I get asked that a lot. I think of it as the gentle answer is kind of the answer I gave you 2 minutes ago, which is my biography, things like that. And there's, you know, more to that story, too. The book also covers what happened to my dad. You know, I was very young when he had a brain injury, and so I grew up, you know, I think being around that kind of existential question of reality. But the tough answer really is, especially if it's a white person who's asking me that question. I'm also speaking here as a teacher. You know, how do I deal with this in the classroom? There's a necessary level of discomfort, I think, to get inside what I'm talking about. And if I just kind of give the answer to somebody, they won't actually get the answer, if that makes any sense. So sometimes refusing to get it and just say, you need to maybe ask that question of yourself.
You have a poem called Ways to Be White in a Poem, and it's inspired by a poem called Ways to Be Black mm-hmm. in a Poem. Tell us a little bit about that poem and the writer of that poem and how it animated your own poem.
Well, that poem's written by a very dear friend of mine, Thomas Sayers Ellis, who's another D.C. poet. Oh, goodness. You know, our poetries are very much in conversation. Actually, he has a book out, actually came out 3 or 4 years ago, called Skin Ink. There was something about his title alone, actually, almost wasn't even his poem, but it had me think. In a stage when I was working on this book where I was playing a lot with reversals, like, what if I just switch? And you know, I was thinking of, like, famous titles, like Black Gods of the Metropolis, or titles of famous works that were about African-American concerns or landmarks or things like that, and just playing around and thinking, what if I do white? And I've actually seen a lot of artists do that. And it's a formula for failure, is what I found out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I failed a lot in this book. But it did have me think a little bit. And I think actually that poem ended up being one of the most confessional in the book, as opposed to experimental. I ended up going in the other direction.
Let me ask you to read it for us.
Sure.
It's called Ways to Be White in a Poem. It's on page 32 of your new collection of poems, Dark Sky Society.
Ways to Be White in a Poem. Tension makes a form resound, and so the many lines I am told not to cross. Do not go out alone at night. Do not call attention to yourself. Closer to the color line, the more I am white girl, fool. It is a while before the other girls correct me gently. Good timber needs more air, shout out. Muscles flex, quick shift. I stomp impious, impervious now. Do not dance suggestively, hold a stranger's eyes. That first day in the gym, I asked Thoreau, could I, thinking about cheers, elbows sharp, foregrounded, feet cloud stepping, never of a cheer as the body went up, as if I were not branch, creaking, rope, taut. And maybe you too, whoever you are, reading this, flicker. Do not touch or eat their food. Do not drink from the same cup.
Haylish Hopper, her new collection of poems is called Dark Sky Society. It's published by Western Michigan University Press. When it comes to the subject of race, the sort of obvious experts are people of color, right, in certain ways, in most ways. I think most people's first understanding of it. Is that right? And what do white people have to offer, do you think, in terms of the conversation, the so-called conversation about race and privilege?
Well, race happens in a lot of different places in our lives. It happens in our interiors. And that is true for anyone who grows up in this country. We are racialized, and it inflects the way we think and what we see and, you know, all kinds of stuff, the way we think of ourselves, other people. It also plays out in our relationships. So there's an interpersonal dimension of race, and this is, of course, also true of gender, class. But the really complicated part is the way it plays out in bigger systems, you know, in institutions, in society, and that kind of stuff. So it's hard to talk about race because all those things kind of work together at one time. So one can say, oh, well, we're all racialized, so we're all experts. But we're racialized in really different ways with different benefits packages, you know, attached to that, or lack of benefits, you know, harm packages, violence packages attached to that. So we kind of have to hold both those things at the same time, and that's a difficult thing to do. We can't just pretend that it's universal and it affects us universally, because it doesn't. There are really profound absurd and violent differences between. But there is a sort of shared seam, you know, or maybe we could ask that question, is there a shared seam? I think just looking at the system, the kind of bigger picture, that until white folks start talking about what it feels like to be raced and what it feels like to live in a society that operates with so many racial assumptions and blindnesses and prejudices and things like that, really nothing's going to change. We're the missing piece of the puzzle, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Your field at Goucher is peace studies. What is that, and how does that inform and how is that part of your work as a poet writing about these issues of race?
Yeah. I mean, my training, I didn't get like a PhD in peace studies. I'm a poet working and very fortunate to work in the peace studies program, and certainly am influenced by it a lot. It influences my work, I think, in giving me a space to learn, keep learning, and keep asking questions that I think in many other spaces would be considered
maybe at best unwise and at worst kind of stupid. But I think, you know, peace studies.
Stupid why? How come?
Oh, I think actually a lot of people don't really believe much else is possible. I think we want to believe that something's possible, but when we start talking about other things being possible, I notice a lot of people will put that conversation either in the, oh, that's just, you know, dystopia, you're just talking, you know, always making things out to be problems, or, oh, that's pie in the sky thinking, or that kind of stuff. I think it's pretty hard to hold open a space where we really can talk about what's possible.
Let me ask you to read another poem,
sure.
The Good Caucasian.
Okay.
It's on page 27.
The Good Caucasian, and the epigraph is from Lee Scratch Perry. It's the ghost in me coming out. When 40 acres have besieged my brow, and a mule, and a winter cold as ice cube, I try a remembrance of things floating past, Miss Daisy and her necklace of finger pointing, title pages on the south, now squares of ash, centers embering. If memory be a mountaintop, mine is hidden by fat, puffy clouds and other symptoms. But when disraced in men's eyes and by time, dust, the centuries, I will admit impediment. My body is where we are held. My eyes have drawn your shape and you mine. Not I have a dream, a cold, cold feeling.
Eilish Hopper, her new collection of poems is called Dark Sky Society. It's published by Western Michigan University Press. We've got a link to more information on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Eilish Hopper, it's been terrific meeting you. Thanks for the book and thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
On 881, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us.
Producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's WYPR.org/Maryland Morning.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and now a conversation with one of the great musical artists of our time. Jesse Norman is that rare opera singer who has achieved a level of celebrity enjoyed by actors and rock stars. But to call Jesse Norman only an opera singer is to ignore the wide-ranging repertoire that she's performed and recorded, as well as her other artistic endeavors, which, for example, include curating a groundbreaking festival at Carnegie Hall. She's also been an outspoken advocate for civil rights and a long-standing ambassador for arts education. She has written a new memoir, which she and I will discuss at the Walters Art Museum on Friday night as part of the Pratt Library's Writers Live series. The book is called Stand Up Straight and Sing. And this morning, Jesse Norman joins me on the phone from her home outside of New York City. Ms. Norman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So why did you decide to write a memoir? You've been in front of the public for, gosh, almost close to 50 years. Yeah. And folks think they know you, but I wonder, in this memoir, what would you like folks to know about you?
I would like folks to know about the people who helped to make me, to know about my family. And only I can tell this story. Very often, people that are in the public eye for whatever reason have books written about them rather than writing their own book. And so I was very happy to finally have the opportunity to write the kind of book that I wish to write, which was not going to be a coffee table book, but just a lot of photographs with captions under the photographs, but to actually tell my story, which is not unlike a lot of other stories that could be told by people in the States, but somehow we don't get around to doing that. And I was very, very interested in being able to say in my own words what has brought me to this point in my life.
Well, it really is an amazing journey from your childhood in Augusta, Georgia, to the great stages of the world.
Yes.
I wonder, as you organized it and thought about it and put it together and wrote it, did you find yourself reassessing your life and your career? Did you learn anything new about Jesse Norman?
No, I didn't. I can't say that I learned anything new that wasn't there already. What I did learn and what still fascinates me is how the brain actually functions. Things about which I had not thought for years were absolutely vivid once I had a trigger to bring that to the forefront of my memory. And I was very fascinated by that. And I have two or three friends that are neuroscientists, and I've spoken with them about this. And it is amazing that in this way we've only been studying the brain and how it functions for maybe 60 years. We've been talking about sort of the id and the superego and all of that for a much longer time than we've been actually working on how this incredible organ actually functions. And where is distant memory? And where is memory that happened yesterday? And how is that stored? And how do we sort of make recollections? And that is one of the things that I found so interesting. Because, I could remember, giving myself a trigger talking about being in elementary school, and suddenly I was in elementary school. I could sort of see the classroom. I remembered where my seat was. Of course, we always sat in alphabetical order, so that wasn't too complicated to remember. But I was fascinated by seeing that recollections are there on the hard drive, as I call it, of the brain, and one just has to sort of put in, the right code to have the information come up. It's something that I found really fascinating.
It's really an incredible story as well. You write a lot about your family and about their activities in the civil rights movement. Your mom was registering voters Georgia well before the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965.
Yes.
And you write that it's very important to talk about race and the civil rights movement for people who did not live through that time. I wonder, are you concerned that young people today are not as politically engaged as you and your family were when you were growing up?
Oh, yes, that is very much a concern. And I wonder how that's come about. I don't know whether we're our younger generation, whether they're so preoccupied with getting through school and trying to get a job in this worrisome job market at the moment. But I wish that we would understand, all of us, that it is our duty, aside from our professions, to be fully engaged citizens, which means that we have to participate in what is happening in our communities and to understand what is happening in the social and political lives of ourselves and others, and to know that we should contribute to that as well.
Is there, do you think, a particular responsibility or obligation or even opportunity for artists like yourself and others who have a public forum and public recognition, for them to be politically engaged?
No, I think it is really necessary, not just for people that have a forum and have perhaps their professional lives happening in front of the public, but for all of us. And it's really rather difficult to come to terms with the fact that when we have national elections in this country, that we have a third, perhaps, of the population participating in this franchise. This is something that we really should be ashamed of, and which we should work towards changing, because it really is up to all of us to see to it that we have the government that we want and need, and that the government that sort of is a result of somebody else voting for that.
You write about your experiences on stage. Of course, you've been on so many stages in this incredible career, and you write that the energy of the audience can lift the level of a performance from the stage. How do you sense that energy from the house?
Oh, you can sense energy. You can sense excitement, of course, but you can also sense an incredible listening that an audience might be doing, and that is really wonderful when you feel that everybody, and you can feel this. We need to understand that energy is a living thing, and that we can transport positive energy, and I'm afraid that we can transport the other kind as well. And when you're in a performance and on the stage and the audience is really listening to what is going on, you can do things that you've never rehearsed because you have their attention.
Yeah, and that whole notion of risk-taking on the stage and in the moment, and you've been a great risk-taker all of your life. I mean, just with the kind of repertoire that you've chosen to feature, you sing jazz,
yes.
You've sung spirituals, musical theater, as well
yes.
as opera and recitals, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, who is your ideal listener? I mean, you bring, obviously, your artistry and experience to every performance, but what should the listeners bring?
The listener should bring an open heart and open ears. And be prepared to hear a song that they might be listening to for the first time or a song that they've heard many, many times, but it's going to be perhaps a bit different than they've heard it before, but to be open to that and to be open to the kind of programming that I enjoy and to not come with preconceived ideas as to what an opera singer ought to be singing, and to just be ready for whatever is on the program and to come into that program with an open mind and an open heart.
Well, Jesse Norman, it's been fun talking to you this morning. I look forward to continuing our conversation on Friday night at the Walters. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Jesse Norman's new memoir is called Stand Up Straight and Sing. Miss Norman and I will be at the Walters Art Museum on Friday night to talk more about the book and her amazing life and career. It's part of the Enoch Pratt's Writers Live series, and it's being presented in conjunction with the Walters. It starts at 7 o'clock on the WIPR.org/Maryland Morning for more information. That's it for us today. On Friday, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join me for a conversation about the new show at the Hippodrome Theater, and our movie gurus, Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday, will give us their tips on what films to catch in this holiday season. I'm Tom Hall. Until then, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in Maryland history, in 1948, the House Un-American Activities Committee announced that Whitaker Chambers, a former communist spy, had hidden microfilm of secret documents inside a pumpkin on his farm in Carroll County. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us today. See you Friday.